From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, some Michigan teachers wonder whether any in-person instruction is safe this year.
And they're worried about whether or not, you know, the precautions that a lot of districts are taking, whether or not that will be enough.
Also, one Michigan film critic on mortal threats to independent theaters and the pros and cons of alternative platforms.
There's something about being in an enclosed theater with the Dolby surround sound that is so immersive, and you just can't quite get that when you're in a drive-in.
And finally, the owner of Detroit's Green Mile Grill talks about learning his craft at Lakeland Correctional.
What I really wanted to do was sort of like what Chef Hill did for me. He taught me how to cook five-star dishes. What I wanted to do was bring those type of dishes into my inner city neighborhood.
We'll meet him and the chef who taught him this hour on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, how a Detroit restaurateur went from prisoner to proprietor with help from a prison food program.
Working in a program changed my cooking, period.
That's coming up later in our show. But first, teachers spaced out in lawn chairs in front of the state capitol building today as a means of protest against school buildings opening amid COVID. This happened as many parents are ripping out their hair with worry about how exactly they're going to play the role of educators at home this year. The state's largest teachers union, the Michigan Education Association, says it stands behind any teacher that feels uncomfortable returning to the classroom due to safety concerns. With us to tell more about the many negotiations that teachers, parents, and administrators are having to make in the final days before the school year begins is Lori Higgins, Bureau Chief for Chalkbeat Detroit. Lori, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
What are you hearing from teachers about concerns that they have for the school year?
I think the concerns are pretty common and pretty widespread. I think teachers are concerned about whether or not it's safe to return to school buildings. They're concerned about the fact that Michigan has not seen the drop in COVID cases that it needs to see in order to return to school safely. And they're worried about whether or not, you know, the precautions that a lot of districts are taking, whether or not that will be enough. There's a lot of talk about how, you know, kids are not as susceptible to COVID. They clearly can, you know, can get COVID and can spread it, typically older students more so than younger students. But I think teachers feel like they're being left out of the conversation, that there are adults in the building who can be affected by this virus, and they want people to take them seriously.
Would you say that the concerns are uniform in urban and rural areas of the state?
I'm most familiar, of course, with the urban areas of the state.
Sure.
I do know that there's a group that is holding a rally in Lansing today called My Core, and their membership comes from all over the state, including some rural school districts. And they held a press conference last week, and some of the teachers on that press conference were rural teachers, and they were expressing some of the same concerns that I'm hearing in the urban areas.
Sure. And I imagine that the conversations about what's going on must be going through an awful lot of flux right now. How do you find the teachers that you've spoken with trying to stay on top of what's happening day to day, week to week?
I think that they're reading what's in the media. I think there's a growing interest in what districts across the state are planning to do to see, you know, is there a district that has some novel plan that's different than what my district is doing? So I think there's a lot of interest in that. And I think that they are talking to each other as well. I mean, we see with this My Core group last week, they said this group is only a year old and their membership has increased substantially since the pandemic. And I think that says a lot about the fact that there are teachers that are just looking for a voice with, you know, their colleagues across the state.
Let's get to the article that you published on the MEA's statement. You know, it's one thing to say we will stand behind our teachers. The implication there is that this may come to much more than just a disagreement of words between school districts and teachers. What exactly did the MEA lay out, and what was the format they chose to do that in?
So the MEA executive board had an emergency meeting on Tuesday where they came up with this this motion, that essentially a statement. The implication is that what we're hearing from teachers all over is that they are saying, and we heard this in Detroit last week as well, that, you know, if they don't feel it's safe enough to return to school in September or whenever the school year starts for them, that they may not show up. And what MEA is saying is, if that happens, if teachers in a local unit decide that we don't feel that enough is being done, and we're not coming back, then MEA is going to back them. They're going to support them publicly. They're going to take legal action if they need to, or support them through any kind of legal action. Whether it comes to this, you know, remains to be seen, of course.
Right. I mean, Governor Whitmer always has the option, as she did earlier this year, of just shutting down schools statewide, saying, it's not safe, we're not going to do that. Do you feel like the two sides are kind of hoping that she may make a decision and that it won't come to that?
I don't necessarily think that they're hoping that she'll come to a decision. I think that they hope that she will decide something soon. There's a lot of uncertainty happening right now. Schools don't know what their funding levels are going to be. They don't know whether or not they're going to get any help from the federal government. They don't know whether or not the school year is going to start, in the way that they sort of laid out. Most districts, a lot of districts, I've been looking at a lot of the plans in the last few days, and most of the districts in Michigan are starting the school year remotely. So we probably won't see as much of this action from teachers that the MEA is getting prepared for. I think we're only going to see that in districts that have firm plans to start in person.
Where are the places that you're seeing the most friction between teachers and administrations, and maybe what parents would like to happen?
I mean, Detroit obviously is the area that has seen the most friction. It's where, an activist group filed a lawsuit to stop summer school. It is where the teachers union, as I said before, is publicly saying that we don't think that the district should start the school year in person. But I think, it's happening in other parts of the state. But I think it's concentrated here. But I think even in districts where they're starting remotely, teachers are expressing concerns, because in most of those cases, the districts are saying, we eventually will be coming back. Some are saying we're going to be remote until the end of the first marking period, which in most cases is around the end of October. Mm-hmm. And so then they'll make decisions about whether or not it's safe. And I think we're going to have these conversations again when that comes up. And as far as what parents think, I think parents are mixed. I think that there's a lot of anxiety among parents. They want answers now. They want to know what's going to happen now. They have decisions that they have to make about their own lives, about whether or not, if their kids are learning remotely, are they going to have the capacity to be at home with them, helping them every day? If you look at Detroit, for instance, you have a pretty good mix of parents. You have some parents, a lot of parents, that actually say, I want my kid in school. I want my kid learning face-to-face, because this remote learning is not helping. It's not working for my kid. But you also have a lot of parents that are saying, I'm not ready to come back to the school building. I just don't think it's safe. So trying to meet those needs, it's impossible. You can have, multiple options. And maybe that's the way that districts meet those needs. But I think, probably any education expert will tell you that being in school, being face-to-face, is probably the best for most kids. of course, you also have to think about the health and safety issues.
Right. It's just an awful pile of choices. Lori, we've heard from some frustration from parents who see what's going on in the public sector. They see the focus on getting bars and restaurants and hair salons and gyms back open. And maybe they feel that there hasn't been as much energy on getting schools back open and doing it safely. Would you say that's a concern that's shared by teachers and administrators?
I think so. I mean, I think that here's what I'm hearing from a lot of teachers. Like, they're saying we see the work that districts are doing to try and open safely. We just don't think that there is enough. There aren't enough measures that you can take to make me feel comfortable with coming back. And then you have administrators who are sort of in this position of having to, you know, design a plan and meet the needs of so many people. And there is no perfect plan. They're not going to please everyone, and they're going to have a lot of people who are going to be upset with them.
Well, Lori, at this point, are you anticipating a start to school with the conditions on the ground as they are right now?
If I had to predict right now, I'd say, just given the data that we have right now, you know, the COVID cases are plateauing, but the state is saying we need them to be dropping. It's hard to predict because we don't know what the next couple weeks or few weeks are going to bring us with when it comes to COVID. But if I were to guess, I would guess that we may be in a position at the beginning of the year or close to the beginning of the year where the state is going to say, we're just not where we need to be. That's my guess. You know, it could go a lot of different ways. I mean, we've heard so many stories about outbreaks in different parts of the state, particularly related to young people, that could have an enormous impact on whether or not the conditions are going to be ready, kind of be where they need to be to open schools for in-person learning.
Lori Higgins is Bureau Chief for Chalkbeat Detroit. Lori, thanks for talking to us, and stay safe out there.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. While a great many of our comfort pastimes are still within reach, restaurant food, Michigan's parks and beaches, and even some sports, there is one form of recreation that some of us are missing hard: movies. Sure, streaming services are going gangbusters, and a handful of new releases have made it into your home, like the pop star-studded animated film Trolls World Tour. But outside those few titles, it's been a while since some of us have seen a new film, and even longer since we've been able to see it with seats planted in a theater, bucket of popcorn, and a drink in reach. Andrea Riley is a film critic for the website The Movie Sleuth. She's based in Madison Heights. Andrea, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So how do you see the movie theaters that you know being affected by COVID-19? I mean, obviously, they're not doing regularly scheduled screenings, except for, I think, a few in the Upper Peninsula.
Yeah, I think that is right. It's been really, really strange to just not have theaters to go to. I mean, it was one of my favorite things to do, being a film critic. And now I don't have that option. And it's almost eerie seeing these parking lots just completely empty all the time. So, I mean, it's impacted my life completely. And a lot of my fellow movie sleuths are also hurting too as a result of it. And gosh, I hope things can get back to normal sooner than later, but I'm a little worried.
For sure. I see that some of Michigan's theaters have started to offer drive-in movies. The Imagine chain has actually started up. They were never in the drive-in business before this, but they've started to offer it, I believe, in their parking lots. Have you been to any drive-in movies this season at all?
I have not. I have been wanting to. I know the Ford Wyoming has been showing a lot of movies, and I've really wanted to do that this summer, but I have not gotten around to it.
You know, it's awesome, and I haven't been to one since I was a kid, but I do wonder how it changes the movie-going experience, especially with some of today's films. Do you think that there's a difference between seeing them at the drive-in and what we might get in the theater?
Oh, 1,000%. There's, you know, something about being in an enclosed theater with the Dolby surround sound that is so immersive, and you just can't quite get that when you're in a drive-in. I think that both of them have their own place, but I don't think that drive-ins are going to be able to replace the, you know, standard movie theater completely. It's just not possible with the way everything's set up.
I wonder, the things that we see happening in the movie industry, I mean, I've been sitting here watching the release date for Wonder Woman 84 get pushed back and pushed back and pushed back, and I'm absolutely dying. Can you tell us a little bit about what's going on with the movie industry? It seems like they're at war with streaming companies who release exclusively on their own platforms instead of in theaters. Do you see what's happening right now changing the balance of power in their fight?
I do. I can absolutely see a lot more of the smaller films just immediately getting released on streaming. But I think that there will still be that demand to go to the theaters. I mean, you can't have a spectacle movie like the new Star Wars or Avengers, you know. You can't just release that to streaming. I just can't see that happening. I mean, I know like right now we have Mulan. They expected it to make over $1 billion at the box office. And now it's being released for $30 a pop on Disney Plus. So, I mean, things like that are happening. And I think they are testing the waters to see if that this is a more viable thing to be able to do in the future with more of their films.
Do you have a sense? I mean, the Mulan release is obviously a big test case that I think a lot of people are watching, and Disney's really flexing its muscles with what Disney Plus can accomplish. I mean, how close to, you know, 100% of that expected box office do you think Disney is going to get with the Disney Plus release?
You know, it's hard to say, but I know that Trolls World Tour did an amazing job just being released via streaming. And I can see that happening for Mulan, too, because, I mean, I think families are looking for entertainment, you know, to keep their kids having fun during this whole mess and everything. And I think that right now, at least, people would be willing to pay the $30. Whether that continues, if we find a vaccine and everything and things just start to have a sense of normalcy again, I think that that would start to get a little steep for some people, but I think that they'd be able to make up some of their money for sure.
I guess the ones that I really worry about are the independent movie theaters. When I think of towns that are fortunate enough to have like a single screen downtown or like a two screener, what do you think is going to happen for independent theaters during this time?
That's something that I've been ruminating about lately. And I'm really worried for them. But on the same note, I think that a lot of them have a lot of creativity, and they have these loyal indie movie theater goers that just really want to see them succeed. So they'd be willing to donate to different fundraisers that they have. Maybe they'd have different events that aren't necessarily movie related to make up for the amount they've lost. I do think that this will send a lot of them out of business, very sadly. But I don't see them going away completely, because they're just such a cultural institution for so many people that people really want to see survive.
I mean, I guess if nothing else, we can say that the streaming era has at least gotten consumers a little bit more used to, you know, the thought of just seeing a movie at home that in other cases they might have gone to an art house venue to see.
I would say that's true, but I just really hope that that's not the only place that we can see them in the future.
For sure. For sure. Are you aware of any theaters in Michigan that have announced closure already?
Let me think. I don't think so. I think that they've been just trying to hang on as far as I can tell. I mean, the ones around me, Main Art Theater, which I used to work at back in the day, I think that they're still trying to survive, and I think everyone is. I don't think any formal announcements have been made yet.
Well, I guess we can be thankful for that. Tell me a little bit about some of the better movies that you've seen this season that might have slipped under the radar for folks.
Well, one I just saw was The Rental. Dave Franco's new movie. And I don't know if I would have necessarily seen that if it weren't for the fact that it was on streaming. I really enjoyed it.
It's a horror movie, isn't it?
It is a horror movie. You know, I would say that it's a little more suspense than horror, but as it progresses, it gets slightly more like a horror film. But I thought it was a great, well-done film for his first directorial, you know, film. And I thought that that was one of the highlights for me this year, at least.
It seems impossible to calculate how many films we might have been seeing this year that just kept getting pushed back, like we said. I know that Marvel had a big release with Black Widow coming out in May. Mm-hmm. What happens to movies that get pushed back? I mean, can we be assured that these will eventually be released in one way or another?
I would say we can be assured that we're going to see Black Widow in one way or another. I think ideally they really want to show it in the theaters, because any of those Marvel movies, I mean, they're such a spectacle. They're just begging to be seen on the big screen. But I think dependent on how Mulan does, I think that we might just end up seeing it on streaming this November.
I suppose studios have too much invested in these films to just let them fall by the wayside at some point.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. You mentioned that there are some films that are just best suited for an in-theater experience. What about a kind of film that might make more sense to you to see at a drive-in? Like, is there something that if you saw it on the, if you see it in the listings that you would absolutely drive out to see?
Yeah, I think all of those classic midnight movies, style movies, are just perfect for a drive-in. So I can 100% seeing myself go to one to, say, do a double feature of, you know, classic horror films, you know, and then just any like slightly more low budget, like campy horror film or something, something that I can watch as a more social experience that I wouldn't mind a little bit of distraction. Or
you mean, you know, it's okay to talk during? You mean it's okay to talk during the movie? One of those.
Exactly. Sure. Any film like that where you don't have to be, you know, glued to the screen the entire time, and someone can make a comment here and there, and it won't annoy me.
I have a friend in New York State who caught a double feature of The Great Muppet Caper and Smokey and the Bandit.
Oh, nice. That's a fun one.
Or maybe it was the Muppet movie. I can't remember exactly which.
Okay. Love them both. Big Muppet fan.
Well, I know this is sort of long range, but, you know, awards season is probably going to happen this year, whether the theaters open or not. I don't even know whether there would be an Oscar ceremony under current conditions.
Right.
But do you see the pandemic altering awards season this year?
Absolutely. I mean, I've been thinking about that too. And, you know, thinking about like, well, how are they going to do the red carpet? Are we just going to see like the celebrity sitting on their couch with their tuxedos and gowns on and just cutting from one to another on like a Zoom call? Like,
Charlize,
like, that would just be so surreal.
Charlize Theron, like on the Chase Lounge by the pool. I don't know.
Exactly. I mean, in a way that almost kind of has its own strange appeal. And I definitely think that the awards will be changed this year for sure. But I think that most people will want their traditional, you know, big award ceremonies and everything once the pandemic dies down. I think it will return to normal once life starts returning to normal, but not this year.
Well, Andrea, hang in there. I mean, it's a tough time to be a film critic, but thank heavens for streaming.
Exactly.
Andrea Riley lives in Madison Heights. She's a film critic for the website The Movie Sleuth. Andrea, thanks for talking to us. It's good to hear from you.
Thanks so much for having me.
This week, we've been exploring systemic racism in the food and agricultural sectors. As the stateside team was putting these conversations together, we started thinking about a chef we met. He runs a food tech program at Lakeland Correctional Facility, Chef Jimmy Lee Hill. The food tech program was part of an award-winning documentary that Stateside produced called Life on the Inside. We're going to catch up with Chef Hill in just a few minutes. But first, just to get you grounded, let's revisit the program at Lakeland Correctional.
Okay, so right now we're getting lunch ready. Today we're going to have a roasted beef tenderloin with a squash sauce that is also has a demi-glaze, and it'll be sitting on top of creamed leeks. My name is Jimmy Lee Hill. I'm the executive chef instructor here at Lakeland Correctional Facility in the Culinary Arts Program, and I've been here for 30 years. We get the guys ready for after incarceration. So basically what we do is we teach them everything from safety and sanitation to catering and everything in between. It is my hopes that I get them ready to go to more of high scale dining so that they can secure a job enough to where they can, you know, support their families.
He goes on the tip. My name is Charles Ralston. I'm from Lapeer County. And right now I'm just braising these beef tenderloins in some rosemary and thyme and butter. And I'll put them on a pan and we'll finish roasting them in the oven to medium. And I'm about ready to put a few more on. I first took this program in 1992 under Chef Jimmy Hill. And I got out and came back. And I've been here for 7 years as a tutor now. These spices were in the garden 10 minutes ago. Right before I started, I went out and picked them. What I'm here for is to facilitate what Chef does, because he's only one person. We have 50 people in the class. I help with the math, and I help. I'm sous chef, so I help with the kitchen work and the cutting and teaching them, and just try to give them some skills so when they go out there, they can know what they're doing and not just be thrown into a fast food situation. Everything in that we could have used from the garden we did today. We still have stuff out there like cabbage and carrots, and another run of lettuce is coming, and we have kale, and this program is my whole life. And we're just talking about this morning about dreaming and stuff. Sometimes I'll be sleeping and I'll wake up and with an idea and I want to tell Chef. But, you know, I just go back to sleep. It's the opposite of a nightmare. It's a unique opportunity to teach these guys and see their faces when you show them something and the light comes on and you just see it in their faces. And, I mean, it hits you in the heart, you know what I mean, that you're doing something that is actually means something, something that they'll take with them and they'll remember for the rest of their life. Just baste them a little bit with this butter and rosemary and thyme and give them some nice flavor. Something so simple just makes things taste so good.
Well, okay, as soon as this gets to the smoking point, we're going to start dropping the scallops in.
Well, this is the garde manger department. So what we do over here is cold salads. We also do soups and some other different types of salads. Well, my name is Christopher Dorch. I'm from Detroit, Michigan. I've been at this facility for about 4 years, and I've been in food tech something about a year now. These will be pan-seared scallops. They'll be going for a corn scallop and bacon salad. Well, I've been to many different facilities. I've been locked up now for something like 28 years. So I've been to various different facilities, and this program is unlike any program that I've seen at any other facility. It gives you the opportunity so that you can develop your skills, so that you can express yourself, and so that you can make a contribution. And I think that's mainly because of the instructor that we have, Chef Jimmy Hill. He allows us the freedom to be able to experiment, but not go crazy. I think that's important. I'm going to do the first one, kind of give you a demonstration, and then what I want you to do is you'll take over doing what it is that you see me doing. When I was in the free world, I was doing short order cook, also in fast food restaurants. In other facilities, I've been clerk, production cook, actually diet cook, all the positions actually in food service. I've worked those, vegan cook, a lot of different things. You can see it starting to get to the smoke point. At that point, we know that our grease is pretty much ready. It's very important when we're doing these scallops that we have a hot pan. To get through my time, I do things like I draw. I love to cook and bake. Actually, I love baking more so than anything else, but educating myself a lot, that helps me. What I hope personally to get for myself is an opportunity to grow, to build myself, to acquire some skills so that I'll be able to, if I do leave upon release, I'll have the necessary skills to do the things that I enjoy doing. I would hope that other individuals would get from it, not simply the skills as far as the cooking, but the personal skills the chef teaches, the humility, those qualities that we need in order to express our true humanity. Yeah.
That look into the food tech program at Lakeland Correctional Facility was produced by Mercedes Mejia. You can hear the full documentary, Life on the Inside, at michiganradio.org. A year ago in March, Daquan Fistrunk opened up his restaurant, the Green Mile Grill, in Detroit. Then this year, the coronavirus hit. Prior to opening Green Mile, Daquan spent 7 years in prison, most of that time at Lakeland Correctional in Coldwater. And that's where he met his mentor, Jimmy Lee Hill, the executive chef at Lakeland. As you just heard, he runs a food technology program that's designed to give inmates the knowledge and the skills that will help them pursue jobs in the service industry. We called them up today to find out how they're doing and a little bit more about their stories. Chef Hill, Chef Daquan, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for having me.
Chef Hill, I wonder if we could just start out asking how you and the guys that you work with are doing. We know that some 800 inmates tested positive for COVID at Lakeland and that 28 people have died so far. How are you holding up?
Well, it's definitely better than it was. We're back in class now. My students are 25 in the morning and 25 in the afternoon. We are right now doing 6 in the morning and 6 in the afternoons for a total of 12 all day until we work our way back up into the numbers of the capacity of the class.
Could you describe what people learn in the program? Judging from some of the menus I've read about, it sounds pretty intense.
It was always my plan to teach them more than just fast food. Because, I mean, you need to be a little bit more polished to secure a job that you can actually, you know, take care of your family. And so that's why we do a lot of the things that we do. You know, we do prime rib. We do seafood, salmon, oysters, scallops. We do that because they need to know fine dining. And things like that, and then all the things that we grow here.
So there's a farm. There's a farm to table aspect to this.
We basically grow everything, everything but corn. We just can't seem to get that corn stock out.
Well, I can imagine this time of year, you must have an incredible range to work with too. Do you remember when you first met Daquan?
I do. It was actually I walked over to the kitchen. Where the population eats. I see this guy standing in the kitchen there. And I heard him say, who is that guy? And that was the first time that I had ever seen him. He was working in the kitchen. But it was kind of hilarious because, you know, every time someone sees someone that they've never seen before in terms of the inmates, the first question that's out of their mouth is, who is that guy? What's his function? So that was my first encounter with Nimrod.
I hope that's a term of endearment. Yeah,
I guess I should let him explain that the word Nimrod as his name.
Please do.
The Nimrod stems from an alias name that I used. So if you get caught and you get sentenced, whatever name you use, they're going to sentence you under that name. So that's where the Nimrod came from.
Got it.
I made up an alias. You know, I had to think of something good. I couldn't be John Adams because there's 1,000 John Adams in the world. So I had to think of something that was clever.
At least
I thought it was clever.
Daquan, had you ever worked in food service before going into the program, or were you much of a home cook?
I mean, I had an area inside a liquor store before I went to prison. So I was testing the waters to see if I was able to run a business because you can always see like how a restaurant would be open and then you would go like 5 or 6 months later and it'd be closed. But you would never, I never understood why until I got in the food tech program.
Right.
Because you don't count the hidden cost of things. You don't pay attention to the food waste and all those type of things. Like even just like simple as just weighing a hamburger out. If it's supposed to be a quarter pound, then it should be a quarter pound instead of trying to eyeball it where you're giving out five, maybe, you know what I'm saying, more ounces than you should.
So was it like a takeout business in the back of the liquor store?
Yeah, it was a carry out.
What kind of stuff were you making?
Then we were making burgers and fries and maybe some fried fish or something.
Just the basics.
And, you know, like soul food dishes. I do a different soul food dish every day. Meatloaf or some other pork chops, barbecue ribs.
Did working in the program change how you thought about food and cooking?
Working in the program changed my cooking, period. Because like, you know, Chef touched in earlier about the prime rib. When I never knew about the food. I just heard about the program. But then one day I was in the unit and a guy came back with a plate from Food Tech. I'm like, whoa, where y'all get that from?
Mm-hmm.
They say Food Tech. I'm like, man, they ain't got no food like that over there. Not in prison. Sure stuff. That's what they were doing.
Yeah.
But I wasn't really focused on the food as much. And I remember my interview with Chef Hill. He's talking about, yeah, man, you just want to get over here for the food. I'm like, man, I just get over here for the skill and the craft. So that day that I went for my interview, he told me to come back. So when I came back, they were actually, the classroom that I went in, I thought I was in the wrong place because they transformed it into a whole restaurant. I'm like, whoa. So I'm like, man, this is really where I want to be.
Yeah.
So he stuck me in the dish tank.
Well, where a lot of good things get started, I guess.
That's right.
Yeah.
When you got around to opening the Green Mile Grill in 2019, tell us a little bit about some of the foods that you wanted to have on the menu. I mean, I see some sort of meal staples like lasagna there, but it also seems like there's a Southern flair. I saw you were doing seafood boils for a while. What was important to have as sort of the cornerstones of your menu?
What I really wanted to do was sort of like what Chef Hill did for me. He taught me how to cook five-star dishes and appreciate it. So what I wanted to do was bring those type of dishes into my inner city neighborhood where people don't have to, you know, pay out of pocket from going downtown or going to the, you know, the Troy Michigans and all that type of stuff. They can get the same type of food for a lower price, just as good, if not better. You know, it all depends on who you ask. Our everyday menu, which we do different types of sandwiches, we do lamb chops, we do lobster tails, we do chicken, you know, we do our sides, you know, our seasoned rice, our macaroni and cheese, we do potatoes, loaded potatoes, we do broccoli, we do vegetables. And then, you know, every once in a while, we'll do things like the seafood boils, or we'll do the chicken and waffles. Shout out to Bliss, Sarah Sermon, she's amazing.
Right.
That maple syrup. Yeah, so, you know, I want to show my skills at the same time, do it affordably for the neighborhood, if that makes sense.
Yes. If you're just joining us today, my guests are Chef Daquan Fistrunk of the Green Mile Grill in Detroit, and we're also talking with Chef Jimmy Lee Hill, the executive chef at Lakeland Correctional Facility in Coldwater. He's trained hundreds of inmates in food service skills that can lead to long-term career options. Daquan, tell us a little bit about the support that you got in opening the business. What came together to make it, take it from the idea to the reality?
Well, just, you know, a few people believing in what I was selling, I guess. Because it's kind of hard for somebody to see your vision. Oh, yeah, you can cook. Well, let me borrow a few thousand so I can get this going. Ah, man, you know what?
That's a different
You don't cook
story.
That good. In so many words. Yeah, man, won't you just go on a barbecue, you know, or whatever. So what I really started doing was selling dinners out my mom's house where she stay in an apartment building. And it caught fire so fast that she would start getting complaints. So I'm like, man, I can't do this no more here. But in the process, I was trying to, you know, stack up a few coins.
Mm-hmm.
Then finally, a few people, you know, they invested a few dollars. Plus, you know, once the buzz caught kind of fast, it's been that ever since.
Sure. Daquan, I wonder how things have been going for the grill during the pandemic. I mean, so many people are, you know, in a dire financial situation. But at the same time, I can think of a lot of stressed out parents who'd probably love to get their hands on some well-made meals. Are you getting a lot of orders right now?
Man, through the grace of God, that I know it's a lot of bad going on with the corona. But if I just have to say, it's through his grace that we actually picked up, because we were carry out anyway. And once she said that food restaurants that's carry outs are essential, we started getting a lot of different clientele. Now we're getting so many repeat customers and still new customers. So
that's fascinating.
Yeah, it's like word of mouth.
What's your approach? I mean, even though you say you may have an edge on brick and mortar sit down restaurants right now, there are other places people can go for takeout. What is your approach to standing out in an environment where folks may have a lot of different options for what they want to eat?
That's a good question, because it's actually my restaurant, then there's two more restaurants within a quarter mile of me mm-hmm. on the same street. So I approach it like, you know, I was in prison for selling drugs. So I approach the food the same way I approach the drugs. If everybody's doing it, what can I do to make it different? And that's what I say. I thank Chef Hill in the course. Man, there were some guys in the program that was tutors before me, and they taught me so much. So I'm sucking it all in, and I'm looking at it like, okay, if I'm going to sell food and everybody's selling food, what can I do different? So what I do is, like I say, I got a $12 lamb chop meal. It costs an arm and a leg somewhere else. So I sell the best quality stuff. And Chef Hill always told, every meal day, he has stuff shipped in from Canada, from Chicago. I never forget when we had the Feast of the Ocean or whatever. We had a big old seafood feast. Man, it was boxes coming in from all over the world. I'm like, man, that's what I do. I buy fresh every day. I go to the butcher every day. I'm not buying nothing frozen unless it's like a French fry or something. We do fresh, we cook to order, and we try to get the best product for the cheapest price that we still can make money. If I try to sell it for the highest it can be, then I won't sell it as fast because it's so much competition. But if I sell it for where I can make money and sell it faster, then I make more. That's how I approach the same way I approached the drugs when I was, you know, in that life.
So, you know what? Can I just say that I am extremely proud of Daquan, because he went from a prisoner to proprietor, and the odds were really against him, you know, because he came from where he came from. But he did. He buckled down and he took it seriously. And a lot of guys, they do. They come here for the food for the most part, because they hear about the food out on the yard. But then there's those who come in and they are really about the business of food service. And Nimrod was about the business of food service. So that's why we clicked really well, because I seen that he had it in him. So I am extremely proud of him.
Oh, man, you got me about to cry in here.
This is beautiful. Yeah,
it was, you know, it was something I wanted. And it's like, when it's something I want, I put the effort into it.
Did you ever feel that having a prison record held you back from getting employment?
I do remember an instance, because they just opened up a new hotel downtown. It's called the Sonola Hotel, and they were hiring everybody. So I applied for a job. And, you know, with my food tech credentials and all the things that I obtained through food tech, say Michigan Restaurant Association, you know, Management First, man, I'm talking about, I'm kind of like nice on the, you know, the hardware. Plus, I can cook a little bit. So when I went and applied for the job, and other people that was applying, that one little, have you ever been convicted of a felon?
Right.
You know, that
ding, ding, ding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They didn't call me back. No call back. But I know I'm a lot qualified than a lot of these people. You know, but it was cool, because it led me to something else. I didn't give up. I didn't quit, because this is what I really wanted to do.
Chef Hill, it's got to be hard to be working with the guys in the program, looking at what's going on outside. You know, the economic shutdown that's happened as a result of the pandemic has put a serious damper on Michigan's restaurant scene. That's true in Detroit. That's true just about everywhere in the state. What kinds of conversations are you having right now about the prospects for some meaningful work after they're out in the world?
Well, we do have those conversations about, you know, what to do once you get out there to make yourself, you know, employable. We have like a food service symposium that we do every year. And, you know, I bring in chefs and actually a lot of chefs out of the Detroit area. And we have a question that posed to them about how to start that food truck or what chefs look for in terms of verbals and hygiene and, you know, appearance. It makes a difference here because tattoos, for example, a lot of my guys in here, they are tatted up, you know, and a lot of them would say something like, you know, chef, I'm not going to be able to get a job. Look at me. And so I thought one year, you know what, I need to bring somebody in here who looks like this person with these tattoos. And so I started bringing chefs in that had tattoos. And once the students seen them, the first thing one guy said to me was, well, he has more tattoos than I do. I was like, yeah, but that doesn't stop his ability to cook. And that particular person, he growed tremendously within those next 3 or 4 months because he's seen someone that looked like him that wasn't an inmate.
Have you two had a chance to see each other on the outside?
I've laid eyeballs on him a couple of times.
we bumped into each other a couple of times. I just want to comment on that last part about the inmate, you know what I'm saying? The perception of it.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people be thinking like, man, you cooking right now. You ain't going to be doing that when you get out. Or, man, I ain't really trying to do that. Man, this stuff ain't going to work.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, you're going to get out what you put in it. This is what I tell guys, right? You know, up last year, I had opportunity to go back to the prison and to the same classroom. I stepped in the same classroom as a citizen and had the opportunity to talk to the guys. And see, in the classroom, we had this wall. And it's a lot of pictures on there. It's famous people. And it's like the conversation used to always be making that wall. So Michigan Restaurant Association did an article on me. Long story short, I made that wall. So the guys seen me before I even got there. And they synced the story. So it was like a breath of fresh air to a lot of guys that was thinking about it, that was on the fence. Maybe I'm going to do it. Maybe I ain't. Maybe I'm going to take the class series. Maybe I don't. So when I walked in, they was like, damn, that's him. You know what I'm saying? It was mm-hmm. almost that, it was that kind of effect. So like Chef said, just being able to relate to somebody that you can relate to, like far as the guys with the tattoos or the guys that may be thinking that you can't succeed at this, you get out what you put in. If you serious about the cooking game or, you know, being involved in restaurant and hospitality, man, that program is the best thing in the world for your situation because you can transition from it.
Daquan Fistrunk is the proprietor and chef at Green Mile Grill in Detroit. We've also been talking with Chef Jimmy Lee Hill, the executive chef at Lakeland Correctional in Coldwater. Gentlemen, thank you both so much for your time. We really appreciate this.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. We really appreciate your listening. See you Friday.